Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You must remember, a kiss is just a kiss. A smile will forget.
Welcome to another episode of You Must Remember This, the podcast dedicated to exploring the secret and or forgotten stories of Hollywood's first century. I'm your host, Karina Longworth, and this is another episode of our ongoing series, Fact Checking Hollywood Babylon.
Great films of the silent years.
This isn't news. This is totally unfounded gossip.
It's a long way from Hollywood, criticized for dealing too frankly with such themes as sex and nudity.
Hollywood. Babylon.
Today we're tackling the story of Hollywood's first, quote-unquote, Latin lover, Rudolfo Guglielmi, better known as Rudolph Valentino. Here, an excerpt from Hollywood Babylon.
The occasion was the death of the screen's great lover, Rudolph Valentino, on August 23rd, 1926, at 10 minutes after noon, in New York's Polyclinic Hospital. The official cause of death was stated to be peritonitis, following an operation for an inflamed appendix, but rumor attributed his death to an arsenic revenge by a well-known New York society woman whom he dropped after a brief affair while in the city on a personal appearance tour to promote his last film, The Son of the Sheik. Other rumors affirmed Rudy had been shot by an irate husband or that the star was syphilitic and died when the disease struck the brain. During the last years of his life, the dream lover of millions of women had been the butt of a number of unkind attacks in the nation's newspapers, ranging from sneers at his testimonials for Valvoline face cream to remarks that cast a doubt on his virility. These attacks found their origin in Valentino's well-known taste for sartorial extravagance, his famous slave bracelet without which he was never seen in public, his gold jewelry and preference for heavy perfumes, chinchilla-lined coats, and pronounced Italianate coquetry. His virility was further impugned when it became known that the women he married were both lesbians. When Natasha Rambova, Valentino's second wife, whose slave bracelet he wore at all times, divorced him in 1926, it was revealed that the marriage had not been consummated. A similar charge had been advanced during divorce proceedings with his first wife, Jean Acker, in 1922. She accused him of slighting her in the sexual department and of slugging her as well. Rudy married his second lesbian before his divorce decree from his first was final, and this oversight led to his arrest for bigamy. Both Jean Acker and Natasha Rambova were protégés of the exotic and equally lesbian actress Alla Nazimova, Hollywood's most distinguished feminine import at the time. Matchmaker Alla introduced Rudy to both his wives and was believed in Hollywood to have stage-managed both marriages, erratically, to judge by the results. While Rudy may have been maneuvered into matrimony with an assist from Alla, there is no doubt he sought women stronger than himself and was attracted to butch ladies. Valentino called Natasha the boss, and she lived up to the name so well, constantly high-handing her husband's career at Paramount, that Zukor resorted to a contract with a clause barring her from the set. She retaliated by ordering Rudy to leave Paramount. Whatever his private accommodations with his virile wives may have been, the public slurs on his manhood caused him such bitterness that even as he lay dying, fighting stoically against terrible pain, he asked the physicians at his bedside, "And now, do I act like a pink powder puff?" At the news of Valentino's death, two women attempted suicide in front of Polyclinic Hospital. In London, a girl took poison before Rudy's inscribed photograph. An elevator boy of the Ritz in Paris was found dead on a bed covered with Valentino's photos. While Valentino was lying in state at Campbell's funeral home, New York's streets became the scene of a ghoulish carnival. Among those who won admittance to the candlelit bier were Pola Negri, who upstaged everybody by rushing in from Hollywood decked out in chicest mourning weeds. She sobbed and fainted before the coffin and the photographers. Between sobs, Pola claimed she had promised her hand to Rudy. Another claim was immediately filed in the papers by Ziegfeld girl Marion K. Brenda, who stated Valentino had proposed to her in Texas Guinan's nightclub the evening before he was stricken. Valentino's demise at 31 left inconsolable paramours of both sexes to judge by the tear-streaked testimonials. The memory of Rudy was cherished by Ramon Navarro, who kept a black lead Art Deco dildo embellished with Valentino's silver signature in a bedroom shrine. A present from Rudy.
We will deal with this final claim regarding Ramon Navarro and the quote-unquote Art Deco dildo in a later episode on Navarro. In this episode, we will explore Valentino's life, career, and the questions around his sexuality by focusing on three major issues raised by anger. What was behind the newspaper attacks on Valentino's manhood? Were his wives lesbians? And were these marriages arranged by Nazimova? And what role did second wife Natasha Rambova play in his career struggles, such as his conflict with Paramount? Join us, won't you, for the second to last episode of this part of the season, Rudolph Valentino. Born in the late 19th century in Castellaneta in southern Italy, Rudolfo grew up in a middle-class family in which he was very close to his mother, particularly after his biologist father died when the boy was about 10 years old. The future great sex symbol was rejected from a naval academy as a teenager because he was considered too physically slight for the program. Instead, he went to an agricultural school where the daily labor helped fill out his body. He ended up seeking his fortune in Paris, where he learned to dance the tango, and then he moved on to New York. There, he quickly ran out of money and found himself doing whatever odd jobs he could to get by. Sometimes he slept in Central Park or in movie theaters that stayed open 24 hours, running films continuously. He was extremely lonely and homesick. Rudolfo's spirits and his fortunes got a lift when he was hired as a taxi dancer at Maxim's. This meant he was on hand to dance with women who came to the restaurant unescorted, as many did in the afternoons, or whose evening dates did not know the popular dances of the time. This kind of work wasn't sex work per se, but it was sometimes perceived as being adjacent to it. Valentino also gave private dance lessons, which wasn't a euphemism. But again, this work was considered to be about the same as the work of a gigolo. One phrase used in the press for men like Rudolfo at this time was lounge lizards, implying both their laziness and sliminess. Another was tango pirates, the New York Times panicked that tango pirates had replaced white slavers as the sex criminals to be concerned about. Instead of preying on naive young women, the tango pirate exploited lonely, rich, usually older women. Making a steady living in Midtown Manhattan, Rudolfo supplemented his income by working occasionally as a costumed extra in movies. He hoped to act in more films, in bigger parts, but he assumed that because his olive-colored skin was so dark compared to that of the all-American innocents that floated through Griffith-era cinema, he would only find work playing villains. Even that compromised version of stardom was endangered after Rudolfo became wrapped up in one of the biggest New York scandals of the teens. He had landed a good gig as the partner to a dancer named Joan Sawyer. Together, Joan and Rudolfo performed dances like the tango at a circuit of theaters up and down the East Coast. And they even once danced for an audience, including President Woodrow Wilson. Rudolfo was making $240 a week, equivalent to about $5,500 a week today, and he had danced his way into an echelon of fancy, important people, such as the gorgeous Blanca de Salles. This name might sound familiar from our episode on Peggy Hopkins Joyce. De Salles was a Chilean socialite who was married to an American businessman who was neglectful and chronically unfaithful. She ended up shooting her husband over a custody dispute, and Raoul Walsh made a movie about the scandal, starring Miriam Cooper as the gun-toting wife and Peggy as the husband's mistress. Peggy also dated Blanca's real-life brother, Billy Arizuriz, who much later shot himself after a night of drunkenly competing for Peggy's affections with another man. In real life, Blanca was friends with Rudolfo, perhaps more than friends, before she was divorced. Rudolfo had evidence of Mr. De Salles' infidelity because Rudolfo's dancing partner, Joan Sawyer, was the husband's mistress. In Blanca's 1917 divorce trial, Rudolfo took the stand and named Sawyer as a correspondent to the man's infidelity. Blanca got her divorce, and then, just over a month later, apparently by the arrangement of the resentful husband, Rudolfo was caught up in a vice sweep of a suspected brothel. The only two people at the supposed house of prostitution who were there when the police arrived were Rudolfo and an elderly woman named Georgia Time. Both were suspected of operating the House of Sin, but the vice squad could not find anyone who was actually sinning. Still, Rudolfo was sent to jail for failing to post a $10,000 bail. 2 days later, the bail was reduced, Rudolfo paid it, and was set free. But the story was splashed all over the newspapers. And now, with this arrest added to the perception that he had snitched on his former dance partner, it would be impossible for Rudolfo to find work as a dancer in New York. He managed to find a small part in a touring musical, which would take him to California. When Rudolfo arrived in Los Angeles, he started hanging around the Alexandria Hotel, which was the social hub of mid-silent era Hollywood, and the ideal place for a newcomer to hang around if he or she wanted to get noticed. Rudy, as he asked to be called, found work as an exhibition dancer, and then a few criminal roles on screen. His first leading role was as a dastardly Italian nobleman in a film called The Married Virgin. Understanding that no one could spell or pronounce his last name, he asked to be billed as Rudolfo Di Valentini. Soon this would be simplified into Rudolph Valentino. Before Valentino became a star, he met two of the women who would play a major role in the mythic version of his personal life put forth in Hollywood Babylon. At a nightclub in the late summer of 1919, Valentino was introduced to a table full of employees of Metro Pictures, who were celebrating a new film called Stranger Than Death, starring the Stanislavski-trained Russian actress Alla Nazimova. Rudolfo was friends with one of the women at the table, and she happily agreed to introduce him to Nazimova. But Nazimova refused to acknowledge him. She had read about the Blanca de Salle scandal and had wrongly assumed that Blanca had shot her husband because she wanted him out of the way so she could be with Rudolph. As soon as he had slunk away from the table, Alla Nazimova berated their mutual friend. "How dare you bring that gigolo to my table?"
Calling all pop culture enthusiasts.
Are you obsessed with all things celebrity?
Do you live for the drama, the laughs, and the unexpected moments that unfold on social media?
Then you're going to want to tune in to the Comments by Celebs podcast.
Join us three times a week as we deep dive into every aspect of pop culture.
Whether it's dissecting the latest trends or just chatting about your favorite celebs, Comments by Celebs has you covered.
We have new episodes out every week. Follow and listen to Comments by Celebs on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of Nazimova's companions that night, and many other nights, was an actress named Jean Acker. Nazimova had secured a studio contract for Jean, who was reported to be her muse. But Jean's primary girlfriend was another actress named Grace Darmond. Darmond was jealous of Nazimova and wanted Acker to cut ties to the Russian force of nature. Jean wasn't sure what she wanted. When she ran into Valentino at another party a few days later, she apologized on behalf of Nazimova, and Acker and Valentino began making dates for midnight horseback rides. That, again, is not a euphemism. Anger's allegation that Nazimova had arranged Valentino's relationship with Acker seems to be the opposite of accurate, but it is true that Acker had been primarily involved with women to this point. Why she allowed herself to be wooed by Valentino is not clear. But what happened next makes it fairly clear that she was not interested in him sexually. About 2 months after Valentino and Acker first met, the Los Angeles Times reported that he had, quote, dared her to marry him. The apparently impromptu wedding happened at midnight after all had been partying for hours, and afterwards they stayed on the dance floor at the Hollywood Hotel until the band started packing up. Jean had a room at the hotel, and at the end of the night, she went to it and refused to allow her new husband to join her. He gave up pounding on the door eventually and went to his own home to get some sleep. Then Jean snuck out and showed up at the house of a studio executive at dawn, where she declared, "I've made a huge mistake." Then she moved back in with her girlfriend, Grace Darmond. Valentino was totally puzzled. He had apparently ignored all signs that Jean was bisexual, if not strictly lesbian, before the marriage, and now he could not understand why a woman would go through a wedding ceremony at one point in the evening, and then, hours later, refuse to consummate the marriage. He attempted to change her mind. Jean sent him mixed messages, apparently spending one night with him in December, but then refusing to allow him to visit her on set of the movie she was shooting. Rudy showed up anyway to learn that Jean wasn't even there, but at Darman's apartment. There she hid in the bathroom and refused to allow him to see her. He tried to break down the bathroom door. She finally opened it, and they shouted at one another. At one point, Rudy slapped Jean across the face so violently that she fell to the floor. He was immediately full of regrets and apologetic, but they both realized that this marriage wasn't going anywhere good. She told him she would go to Reno to get a quiet divorce. It didn't work out that way, in part because soon enough, Valentino had become a major star. Director Rex Ingram did not want to cast Valentino in Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. But June Mathis, the female screenwriter who had spearheaded adapting the blockbuster World War I novel, had seen the Italian in one of his early roles and insisted that he was the only man for the part of a young Argentinian playboy in Paris whose decadent lifestyle is given meaning, first by war and then by death. Once Valentino began rehearsing the part, Ingram agreed that he had something. Mathis thus reworked the script, transforming what had been an ensemble piece into more of a star vehicle for the Italian would-be star. Specifically, she wrote a scene to showcase Valentino's talents that had no parallel in the original novel. A scene in which Valentino would steal another man's woman, and together, they would dance the tango, their pelvises pressed together, culminating in what was for the time, an absurdly long screen kiss. Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse became the biggest hit film of the year, and Valentino's debut in it was truly a showcase of not just a new star, but an entirely new leading man type. Photoplay described this type as, quote, the continental hero, the polished foreigner, the modern Don Juan. With his relationship with Jean Acker behind them, Alan Asimova had come around on Rudolfo, and before Four Horsemen was released, she cast him as her love interest in her modern-day adaptation of Camille. Nazimova was a great presence, but Valentino was, in his own way, a greater one. Realizing too late that she had been upstaged by this pretty young upstart, Nazimova maneuvered to minimize Valentino in the editing of the picture. By this time, Nazimova had introduced Rudy to the woman who would have the greatest impact on his work and life until he died. Natasha Rambova was born Winifred Shaughnessy in Salt Lake City. Winifred went to European boarding school and then decided her destiny was to become a prima ballerina. At the age of 17, Winifred adopted the name Natasha Rambova to go with her new position with the Russian Ballet Company, where she began an affair with Theodore Kozlov, her much older choreographer, who already had a wife and children. Eventually, Natasha moved with Kozlov, and what one biographer describes as his arty harem, to Los Angeles, where Kozlov had been hired by Cecil B. DeMille. By this point, Natasha had transitioned from dancing into designing costumes and sets, and frustrated by Kozlov's unwillingness to give her his undivided attention and his tendency to use her ideas without proper credit, Natasha accepted an invitation from Nazimova to come work for her. When Natasha tried to leave Kozlov, he shot her in the leg with birdshot. Natasha was definitely leaving Kozlov for a professional opportunity with Nazimova. But was she also replacing one lover with another? Despite Hollywood Babylon's assertion that Nazimova stage-managed Valentino's marriages to two of her lesbian protégés, it's not at all clear that Rambova and Nazimova were lovers. And even if they were, Rambova had plenty of male lovers and husbands, too. Jean Acker was a lesbian who married Rudolph Valentino for unknown reasons and probably never had sex with him. But Natasha Rambova apparently had a real romance with him. They cohabitated together in Natasha's Hollywood bungalow long before they married. In fact, while Valentino was still married to Jean Acker, which, as we'll see, was a problem. In Hollywood Babylon, Anger says Valentino was drawn to quote-unquote butch ladies, but Natasha presented as anything but butch. She clothed and styled herself at the height of feminine elegance, and her look was conventionally, heteronormatively glamorous. What she was an extremely strong personality, and she did dominate Valentino in all aspects of life. After Camille, Valentino left Metro Pictures for Famous Players Lasky, the subsidiary of Paramount, where so many of the stars we've discussed this season were under contract. Natasha was confused and a bit suspicious of this move because Rudy had been claiming since they met that what he really wanted to do was star in art movies, like the kinds she had made with Nazimova, and Paramount made often art-less blockbuster films. But Camille had not been well-received, and Rudy, like many of us, wanted a lot of things. He wanted to be perceived as a great artist and to mingle with great artists, and he also wanted to have a lot of money and mingle with people who had a lot of money. Unfortunately, Valentino sold out for barely any money at all, accepting a contract with Famous Players Lasky that would pay him just $500 a week. This was at a time when Nazimova was making $10,000 a week, and even screenwriter June Mathis was making $750 a week. Famous Players Lasky knew what they were doing, however. They immediately went into production on the film that would rocket Valentino from run-of-the-mill stardom into a space reserved for very few, with a film that would become more intertwined with his persona than any other. The Sheik would star Valentino as an Arab chieftain who kidnaps a plucky Englishwoman. Lady Diana, played by Agnes Ayres, embarks on a bold expedition into the desert, spouting new womanisms like, "Marriage is captivity." Her encounters with the Sheik, though initially non-consensual, have the effect of a seduction. She falls in love, and her radical feminism is tamed. This was all based on a trashy novel in which the rape perpetrated by the Sheik was depicted as much more violent than what the filmmakers could get away with showing. And indeed, since Valentino was supposed to be the hero, his ravishing of the heroine was mostly implied. In fact, his character saves Diana from rape at the hands of an even more unsavory character. This toning down, which was presumed to be a result of the newly installed censors, was considered a disappointment to contemporary reviewers. Variety noted that while the novel had appealed because, quote, "it deals with every caged woman's desire to be caught up in a love clasp by some he-man," the film was, quote, "emasculated." It was the Sheik that transformed Valentino's stardom into a phenomenon. It was a movie that no one thought was good when it was released, which hasn't aged well, and yet its role in launching Valentino as a cultural product is undeniable. It's very difficult to appreciate today the impact then of Valentino's unique look, which reads today as multiracial. Back then, he was roundly mocked by some in the media as the male version of a dumb blonde, a beefcake himbo. With the Sheik as the center of Valentino's image as a star, it has to be noted the extent to which his on-screen persona was supposedly about appealing to female rape fantasies. This was not mere subtext. The idea that he represented every woman's latent desire to be abused was a topic of cultural conversation. His characters were rogues who threw sexual propriety to the wind, sometimes forcing nice girls to do not nice things. And the girls loved it. Most writing about Valentino doesn't consider this to be a bad thing. The assumption is that Valentino allowed women to fantasize about sex that they really wanted to have while pretending they didn't, and that this didn't have a toxic influence on male viewers because male viewers were unable to take him seriously. They may have been more upset by the small subgenre of films in which strong 1920s women essentially talked Valentino into ravishing them. The idea that a man like Valentino, whose manicured look included wearing tight pants and wristwatches, which back then were considered to be jewelry, could inspire women to break the bounds of propriety was more offensive than the idea of rape. The challenge he represented as a foreigner who was more beautiful than rugged to American cowboy masculinity couldn't be tolerated. And as we'll see, it inspired a constant stream of criticism. It was when The Sheik was in release that Jean Acker finally sued for divorce. The sordid details of their brief marriage merged with Valentino's on-screen performances to create a complicated and even confusing portrait of Valentino's sexuality. Some aspects fused productively. The headline of one story about Valentino slapping the bride who wouldn't sleep with him was "Sheik in real and real life charges wife." That's real, R-E-A-L, and real, R-E-E-L. Speaking of confused, Jean Acker's motives were murkier than ever. Now she claimed that she had refused to consummate the marriage after discovering on the wedding night that Valentino was not flush enough to financially support her, in a trial in which she was demanding separate maintenance funds because she had claimed she had become too sick to work. The judge denied this request and rewarded Jean a small alimony. The clock began ticking on the 1 year required to transform an interlocutory decree into a final divorce. This meant that it would have been illegal in the state of California for Valentino to remarry until March 1923. Instead of waiting, on May 13, 1922, Rudolph Valentino married Natasha Rambova in Mexicali, Mexico. What happened was, after shooting Blood and Sand, Valentino had some time off, and frustrated with his studio, who had reneged on a promise to shoot the Spanish bullfighter film in Spain, he wanted to get out of town. He was also spending some of his new salary fixing up a home in which he and Natasha planned to live. But in the climate created by the Arbuckle, Taylor, and other scandals, Valentino understood that he could get in real trouble if anyone found out he was living in sin. A friend of Valentino's had married in Mexico before receiving her final divorce and had been advised by a studio lawyer that it was legal to do so. So in May 1922, they went to Mexicali with a few friends and tied the knot. The wedding night proceeded as wedding nights are traditionally expected to proceed. But the following Monday morning, the LA Times ran a story on the marriage and the quote-unquote possible bigamy angle. Now the studio lawyers decided that Valentino and Rambova had misstepped, and they insisted that the newlyweds separate until the heat blew over. Valentino was advised to turn himself in to the police for having committed the crime of unlawful and felonious cohabitating, which he did. Natasha was put on a train to New York to go stay with her mother and stepfather, and Rudy was put in jail. There he was said to be weeping almost uncontrollably. "I rot here before I deny our sacred marriage," he vowed. His $10,000 bail was beyond what the debt-ridden Valentino could cough up himself, and his studio did not offer to help. Their excuse was that in a scandal-plagued era, it was better to distance themselves from a star in jail than to look like they were endorsing his bad behavior by bailing him out. He remained behind bars for 2 days and nights before a group of friends were able to pool the funds to get him out. According to Hollywood Babylon, at their divorce trial, Valentino was forced to admit that he and Natasha had never consummated their marriage. This is false. What really happened is that Valentino was put on trial for bigamy, and as a ginned-up defense, Valentino claimed that he and Rambova had not slept together since their nuptials because she had become sick on their wedding night. This was plausible because their wedding party did go on past dawn and there was much drinking, which wasn't itself illegal in Mexico, but wouldn't have looked great in a Prohibition-era America courtroom. But drunk or not, Valentino and Rambova did consummate their marriage. Saying they did not was a fiction for the purpose of confusing the issue of whether or not Valentino was guilty of bigamy. And it worked. The judge dismissed the case for lack of evidence of cohabitation. It would still be months before Rudy and Natasha would be free to openly live together and remarry, but she remained the key influence in his life. She had previously played a role in giving his persona a final polish by designing his costumes in films like The Sheik, but she may have also encouraged him to have fun with his persona in a way that pushed the sexuality that he was broadcasting into the arena of camp. She also convinced him that he was worth more than famous players Lasky/Paramount was paying him. And she was right. The studio fostered further animosity by hiring private detectives to spy on the couple to prove that they had disobeyed orders to remain apart. At an impasse over his salary and general treatment by famous players Lasky, Valentino refused to accept a film assignment, declaring he would not work or accept a salary until his demands, which included more money, more input into the quality of his films, better dressing rooms, and the opportunity to work in Europe, were met. The studio offered to raise his salary to $7,000 a week, but by the time the offer came through, Rudy had decided that even that large sum was too little, too late. Famous players Lasky sued Valentino for breach of contract. Valentino countersued. The studio publicity declared that Valentino's absurd demands included the contradictory desire to make more artistic, less commercial pictures, and to get paid higher wages to do so. They also announced their intention to enforce the clause in his contract that barred him from acting for any entity other than famous players Lasky. Thus, at the height of his fame, Valentino was not in a new movie for almost 2 years. During this time, Valentino published a book of poetry produced from automatic writing sessions which had stemmed from his and Natasha's interest in spiritualism, and it became a bestseller. He and Natasha then went on a personal appearance tour together. A cosmetics company named Mineral Lava sponsored the couple to tour around small towns, dancing the tango in front of fanatic crowds. To tie in with the brand's face cream, Valentino would also host beauty contests around the country. The couple were signed to a contract by Mineral Lava, which promised them $7,500 a week, plus a share of the profits. This was a good gig, and an easy one, but Valentino was still smarting from his fight with the studio. Often in the middle of a show, Valentino would pick up a microphone and use it to rant against the movie industry capitalists, whose unwillingness to share their profits or creative control more equally had resulted in the show he was performing at that moment. This tour was already being mocked on the basis that Rudolph Valentino, supposedly the great male idol of the screen, had been reduced to promoting makeup. But the speechifying against corporate interests while on a corporate-sponsored tour was rightly called out as inappropriate. As a fact-checking sidebar, Hollywood Babylon claimed that Valentino did ads for Valvoline face cream, which I guess is a joke, because the motor oil company Valvoline, as far as I can tell, never made cosmetics. Anger could have been riffing on the real cosmetic company, Albaline, which Valentino didn't promote either. But at least one reputable source I read called Mineral Lava a mineral water company. So what can you do? Like nearly everything Valentino did, the Mineral Lava tour drew bad press. But it also had the effect of keeping him current, so that when he did make nice with the studio and return to the screen in 1924, in a film called Monsieur Beauclair, his audience was highly anticipating his comeback. Beauclair, a costume farce set in 18th century France, was co-art directed by Natasha, and it was built in part around Rudy's desire to show off her talents for lavish period costumery, as well as his own ability to fence. Artsy and less flagrantly sexual than his previous hits, it did well in cities but bombed in the bulk of the U.S. The film was attacked as an example of how far Valentino had been led astray by Natasha. Valentino's next film, The Sainted Devil, received a similar response. The attacks on Valentino for essentially being pussy-whipped only increased in 1925, when he began to wear a quote-unquote slave bracelet which Natasha had given him for Christmas. The bracelet, custom made by Tiffany's, based on Natasha's design, featured thin, interlocking links of platinum. It looked nothing like the slave bracelets marketed today, which usually wrap around the wrist and connect to at least one finger by stretching across the top of the hand. That Valentino wore it constantly, even while shooting publicity photos, only increased the chatter about how Natasha wore the pants in the relationship. Valentino, or some publicist working on his behalf, penned articles for fan magazines defending himself against charges that he was a henpecked husband. At least one self-reflexive joke about the conversation surrounding Valentino's manhood made it onto the screen. In Valentino's second-to-last film, The Cobra, released in late 1925, the Latin lover is accused of being nothing but an indoor chic, meaning his prowess was limited to the bedroom, and that elsewhere, he was less than a man. Answering the single taunt on screen and the multitudes of them off, Rudy punched his critic out. Unfortunately, The Cobra was a dud, and Paramount held it from release while trying to figure out what to do about Rudy's flagging career. In the press, Natasha was blamed for squandering Rudy as a resource. A blind item in Variety gossiped that a star's wife has been running matters and provoking resentment from workers on set. Finally, with his old contract due to expire, Valentino was offered a new deal at United Artists. He would get a substantial salary raise and would be allowed to make the artistic films he was drawn to. But Natasha would not be allowed to participate in the making of his movies. Faced with the decision to salvage his slumping career or stand by his wife, Rudy chose his career. As a consolation prize, Rudy's manager personally provided $30,000 to help Natasha produce her own film, called What Price Beauty. That production kept her busy, busier than Valentino was in the period before his United Artists contract kicked in, and the couple became estranged. having signed the devil's bargain that would exclude his wife from working on his own films, Rudy began to resent the work she was doing outside of the home. He was also feeling his biological clock ticking, and Natasha was insistent that she didn't want to have children. She didn't intend to ever give up working, and she didn't want to generate a child only to hand it over to domestic employees to raise. All of these factors led the couple to split up, and in the fall of 1925, Valentino began dating Pola Negri. The Polish actress had made her mark, starring in several films for director Ernst Lubitsch. She was exotic and dramatic, on screen and off, and she was crazy about publicity. This latter fact has led many to suspect that hers and Valentino's relationship was not entirely genuine. There were a few facts that suggested that one or both partners were using the other. Pola loved her publicity, but Rudy may have needed her publicity factor even more. With two failed marriages and a few disappointing films behind him, Rudy needed to assure audiences, and possibly himself, that he was still a potent lover. Pola Negri would have been the right person to attach himself to, given that she was as extravagant an example of female sexuality as existed in Hollywood in 1926. And yet, Negri didn't inoculate Valentino from the tired old gay bashing that columnists had been tossing at him to reaffirm the old-fashioned self-image of the American male for years. But if any single attempt to defame Valentino as queer stuck, it was a column that greeted the actor when he traveled to Chicago that summer to promote the sequel that United Artists hoped would turn Rudy's career around, The Son of the Sheik. In an unsigned editorial in the Chicago Tribune, columnist John Herrick blamed the installation of a face powder dispensing machine in a men's restroom at a dance hall on Chicago's North Side on Valentino. I didn't include it in my excerpt from Hollywood Babylon because it was too long, but Kenneth Anger reprints this article in full. The gist of it is to connect the presence of a powder dispenser, in other words, the suggestion that men who dance would need to touch up their makeup, which was equivalent to suggesting that such men were gay, to the challenges to masculinity that Valentino represented via, quote, masculine cosmetics, chics, floppy pants, and slave bracelets. The columnist asked the question, why didn't someone quietly drown Rudolph Guglielmo, alias Valentino, years ago? This became known as the Pink Powder Puff editorial, and Valentino could not and would not ignore it. He responded by publishing a letter in a rival Chicago newspaper, publicly challenging editorial author John Herrick to a boxing match. Herrick never responded, and Valentino seemed to come out on top of the publicity scrimmage. He was able to poke fun at the whole thing when the press tour took him to New York by engaging in a stunt sparring match with sports writer Frank Buck O'Neill. It was clearly a photo op, but when Rudy floored the much larger O'Neill with a single punch, he got the counter headlines he wanted. Maybe he had learned a little something from Pola Negri. Rudy spent the next few weeks in a flurry of promotion and partying. Though he was plagued with abdominal pain, he frequently overate, drank alcohol, and smoked at least two packs of cigarettes a day. One night in August, Valentino went out on the town and ultimately met up with a Ziegfeld girl named Marion Benda. Not, as Hollywood Babylon has it, Brenda. They drank and danced, and then around 1:30 a.m., Valentino suddenly doubled over in pain and was rushed to his apartment at the Ambassador Hotel. A doctor was called, and by morning, it was decided that Valentino needed to go to the hospital. Within a few hours of arriving at the hospital, Valentino was operated on twice. The first diagnosis was appendicitis. Then the doctors realized that he actually had perforated ulcers, which were mimicking the symptoms of appendicitis. The first thing he is noted to have said after waking up from the anesthesia was, "Did I behave like a pink powder puff or like a man?" Pola Negri was working in Hollywood and couldn't get away to be by Valentino's bedside. Natasha sent concerned telegrams. Jean Acker, with whom Valentino had become platonic friends, was the only woman in his life who was able to visit him in the hospital. The operations, at first, seemed to have been successful. But from one or the other, he contracted an infection, peritonitis, the same cause of death of Virginia Rappe 5 years earlier, and Jean Harlow 11 years later. The real killer is when the infection spreads throughout the body, causing problems that the immune system can't fight off. And back then, there were no antibiotics to help out. In Valentino's case, the infection spread to his lungs, and 10 days after entering the hospital, on August 23rd, the 31-year-old Rudolph Valentino was pronounced dead. The death was sudden and shocking, and at the time of his passing, in the midst of the publicity tour for the highly anticipated and well-reviewed sequel to the film that had made him a superstar, Valentino was more famous than all of Thomas and Wallace Reed had been in the days leading up to their demises. Plus, more than those other stars, Valentino's whole star image had been about fantasies of the exotic and the impossible. How could such an icon just die, so young, and from something as mundane as ulcers? There were rumors that something else had happened, a fire stoked when one of Valentino's attending physicians commented that there had been a hole in his stomach. But those close to him had observed that he had been complaining of pain and fatigue for some time. Anger mangles some of the details, but there were suicides in the wake of Valentino's passing, and showgirl Marion Benda did come forward and claim she was Valentino's real left-behind fiancé. When his body was presented for viewing at a New York funeral home, the crowds were massive, up to 90,000 people over the course of 2 days, and strangers trampled one another in fear that they wouldn't get a glimpse of the beautiful corpse. Pola Negri finally broke free of her movie commitments and boarded a train for New York. One of the pallbearers at the funeral, actor Ben Lyon, quipped that as soon as she arrived on the scene, she attempted to turn this sad occasion into, quote, a premiere for Pola Negri. Pola earned little sympathy in launching a publicity campaign to be considered Valentino's official widow. But in this, she had the support of Paramount, whose chief exec, Adolf Zucker, allegedly sponsored Negri's assault on Valentino's funeral and ordered, "Get her first-class accommodations, a doctor to travel with her, and, of course, a good publicity man." The publicity backfired on Pola, and even if she had been Valentino's legitimate widow, there wouldn't have been any money in it. He died in debt, in part thanks to his taste for the elegant accessories that helped to define him, and in some eyes, doomed him to endless speculation over his sexuality. As promised earlier in the episode, we will talk about Valentino more in a future episode on Ramon Navarro. But first, next week, we will wrap up part one of our Hollywood Babylon series with the sad story of the last great American sex symbol of the silent era. Join us then, won't you?
Thanks for listening to You Must Remember This. Today's episode was written, narrated, and produced by Karina Longworth. That's me. Our editors are Sam Dingman and Jacob Smith. Our research and production assistant is Lindsay D. Schoenholtz. Our social media assistant is Brendan Whalen. Original music was composed for this season by Evan Viola. And our logo was designed by Teddy Blanks. Special thanks to our special guest, John Hodgman, who read From Hollywood Babylon. For more information about this episode and other episodes, please go to our website, youmustrememberthispodcast.com. There you'll find show notes for every episode, which include links to our sources. If you like the show, please tell anyone you can, any way that you can. You can follow us on Twitter at RememberThisPod, and we're on Facebook and Instagram too. And if you are a fan of this podcast, perhaps you'll also like my new book. It's called Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood. It comes out on November 13th. But you can pre-order it now at Amazon.com or HarperCollins.com. We'll be back next week with an all-new tale from the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. Join us then, won't you? Good night.